once again to the Mike Wilson Show on WWGH. My guest today is quite, you're all familiar with him. He's a local history aficionado. Is that a word, Fred?
Yeah, I can barely hear you, Mike.
You can barely hear me? Hold on. We're having trouble with this mic. Okay, am I any better?
Nope.
No better. Okay. Let me go to another microphone. Hold on just a second.
Sounds like you're in a tunnel.
Uh-oh. Okay, folks, we're experiencing some technical difficulties there. Okay, Fred, is that better?
That's much better.
Okay, we went to a different microphone. There seems to be some difficulty with that one. This is, of course, Fred Malone on the line with me, and we're going to talk about history today, I believe.
Yes, we are. I have a topic that I want to talk about in depth a little bit later on, but I wanted to start out with kind of updating folks with where the museum was at this particular point in time. And what was going on with a couple of the other groups or activities that people know that I'm associated with, Malabar Fire Hawk Historical Society. So starting off with Marion County, the Marion County Historical Society and the museum at Heritage Hall, we are open. I don't know whether people know, but we are open. We're doing our regular summer, fall hours, I guess you could say, spring, summer, fall hours. We are open Wednesday through Sunday from 1 in the afternoon until 4 in the afternoon. We certainly encourage people to stop in and take in the museum and see the new exhibit. We were, of course, as you know, Mike, closed for a considerable amount of time when the COVID outbreak started back in March. That would have normally been our time to open. And we, of course, were waylaid there, so we didn't get open until about a month ago. So we've been running our regular hours now for about a month, and the exhibit is really a great one this year. We've been planning this for quite some time because it is the 100th anniversary of Warren Harding being elected President of the United States. So our featured exhibit in the atrium section of the museum, which is the main part of the museum when you come in the front door and pay your fee and go into the big room in the museum, that's what we refer to as the atrium. That area this year is comprised of things that occurred in Marion in the 20s, in the 1920s, especially hitting, you know, 1920, the year that he was elected, and of course 1921 when he took office. So do strongly encourage people to take that in. We did not open Lynn School this year at all. Of course, as everyone knows, we had a truck ran through the front of it here about a year ago. And we probably could have gotten to the point where we could have opened, you know, maybe in May or June. However, that's when things were, you know, not going so well with COVID. So we opted to just suspend this season and not open this year. So unfortunately, Lynn School is not open. But we do have some things on the horizon with Lynn School and for that whole property out there that we've been considering, and we'll talk about that at a later date. But just to update folks, that is not open. We did have to cancel all of our major events this year. I think I may have mentioned this on Glenn Coble's show the other day, but I'm thinking maybe you guys might have different audiences, so I thought I'd better mention it again. We did have to cancel all of our major events. Our Night at Heritage Hall, which normally occurred every year in March, and that's what I think would have been about the 16th year for that, mm-hmm. Had to be canceled. Then we had to cancel our men's president's luncheon back in May, and then also our ladies' luncheon in August. And unfortunately, we just recently made the decision that we're going to have to cancel our Dinner with the Presidents, which is our big fundraiser that we have every year that you're familiar with, of course.
Oh, yes.
Having served as President William Henry Harrison a couple of times and also as a guard for the 121st Ohio Volunteer Infantry. So it just wasn't feasible. With the way the banquet hall that we were using there at the Dayspring Wesleyan Church, we could have gotten maybe 150 people in there. Our normal is 300, but Logistically, with no buffets these days, it would have taken considerably longer to serve folks. And I don't know, there's just something about seeing somebody like Thomas Jefferson or Abraham Lincoln with a mask on that just didn't, aesthetically, it just didn't work out too well.
Yeah.
So, unfortunately, that event has been canceled for this year. Talking about possibly trying to do a dinner with the presidents maybe in the spring, and then again maybe in November. You know, that's still up in the air. We definitely will go back to November next year, but we thought we might try maybe an abbreviated version or maybe an expanded luncheon version sometime in the spring, but more to come when that time gets a little closer. But we are open. As I said, the museum is open Wednesday through Sunday, 1 to 4, and we certainly would encourage everyone to stop in. The gift shop is well stocked with books, and of course we have some of our old familiar items that never change. Prince Imperial, of course, is in his same spot waiting to greet everybody when they come in, and the Popcorn Museum is open too as well. So we'd like to see folks stop in and take a look at the new exhibit. With regard to Malabar, basically everything over at Malabar is shut down too. The events have been canceled. This would have been the weekend coming up for the annual Ohio Heritage Days, which is always the last weekend in September. That, unfortunately, this year had to be canceled. The house is closed and will be closed for the balance of the year. We're not quite sure yet whether the harvest dinner will take place. That's the dinner that folks come and they go up to the pew cabin and they help cook the dinner and over the open fire, the open hearth there in pew cabin, and then it's like a Thanksgiving type feast. That still is on the schedule, but that's a limited number of folks. I think 30 is a cutoff on that. If you are interested, you can go to the website and or call the farm to see whether or not they're taking reservations for that, whether they're full up. And, again, it could be canceled. You know, it just depends on the state. Everything is definitely shut down through the 31st of October. So, you know, we're not quite sure about that. And then the Christmas open house, which takes place in November, the first couple of weekends in November, that's still up in the air. So kind of keep you apprised of those things as they go along, but you can always check the Malabar.org website and see if those things are going forward. With regard to Mohawk Historical Society, the museum up in Sycamore, the board of directors did decide that they will keep the museum closed for the balance of this year, so that probably will not open, I would say, until maybe sometime after the first of the year. That still has to be decided. We did build a new building up there. I think I've mentioned that before.
Yes, you have.
And that is fully stocked and ready to go. But with COVID, the way things are right now, and the size of our museum, it's not a particularly big museum, so social distancing would be a little bit more difficult for us than it would be for the Heritage Hall because of the size there. So definitely all society events and everything have been canceled throughout the balance of the year, so we'll keep you posted on how those things are going. A new feature I wanted to add to this kind of monthly thing that I do, in addition to my main topic, which we'll get to here in about 5 minutes, I want to talk about some famous Ohioans kind of every month when I come on. And I thought I'd start off with Chief Pontiac, the Indian chief. And the reason I wanted to do this is I've been reading a lot of Alan Eckert lately. And for folks that don't know, Alan Eckert was an Ohio author that wrote considerably about the early frontier, which Ohio was considered, wrote about the Northwest Territory, wrote about Tecumseh and Blue Jacket and people like that. I thought I'd talk a little bit about Chief Pontiac, and then as we go on, we'll talk about other famous Ohioans. Chief Pontiac was born sometime around 1720. Obviously, we don't know exactly. His father was an Ottawa, and his mother was a Chippewa. His family raised him as an Ottawa, although he had numerous friends among his mother's people, the Chippewas. Little is known about his early years, but He probably traded with French merchants that had been moving into what's now modern-day Michigan and Ohio back in the late 1600s and 1700s. By 1755, he had become an important leader of the Ottawas. Pontiac subscribed to the religious beliefs of the Nealon, which is a prophet among the Lenape Indians during the 1760s. This kind of encouraged his fellow American Indians in the Ohio country and parts west to forsake all British goods and customs. They kind of felt that the American Indians' dependence on these items had infuriated their gods, especially the liquor that was being provided to them by some of the trading posts.
Oh, yeah.
The reason why the American Indians in the Ohio country currently suffered at the hands of the British was because they had forgotten the true ways of their own people. European ways would condemn the American Indians to eternal suffering. Nealon encouraged American Indians to separate themselves from the European ways and not become dependent on them. Although he encouraged American Indians in the region to reject the European customs, missionaries from the Moravian Church also had influence on his views and what he called the Great Spirit. And if you'll remember, the Moravians had a big influence on the Wyandots up in Wyandotte County in Upper Sandusky.
Mm-hmm.
Pontiac was definitely influenced by the revivalism, but felt that the American Indians had to remain militarily strong to drive the Europeans out of the Ohio country. This, of course, became especially important with the conclusion of the French and Indian War in 1763. The Treaty of Paris turned all French lands in North America over to the English. American Indians feared the loss of their traditional ally and also believed that British settlers would flood the Ohio country, which to some extent they did. To prevent the incursion of whites, Pontiac and the Ottawa encouraged the Ohio country American Indians to unite and rise up in 1763. The Ottawa attacked Fort Detroit in May of that year, and of course many people today view this as the beginning of Pontiac's rebellion. The Shawnee, the Munsee, the Wyandotte, the Seneca Cuyahogas, and the Lenape also raided British settlements in the Ohio country and in western Pennsylvania during that same year. In the autumn of 1764, the British military took over the offensive against the American Indians. Colonel John Bradstreet, which is a name I think we're all familiar with, and Colonel Henry Bouquet each launched invasions to the Ohio country from Pennsylvania. Pontiac's rebellion eventually ended in the autumn of 1764, but Pontiac did not formally surrender to the British until July of 1766. The British promised him no harm as long as he agreed never to wage war against the British again. Pontiac spent the remainder of his life with his family on the banks of the Maumee River, and that's up, of course, near Toledo. In 1769, Pontiac was murdered by an American Indian. It's not clear why he was killed. There is some thought that the British may have paid a man to kill Pontiac to deprive the Ottawa of one of their leaders. But on the other hand, it may have been the work of a group of American Indians who were upset with his refusal to wage war against the British. Mm. His death, like most of his life, remains a mystery. His dream of a united American Indian front against the Anglo-American encroachment on American Indian lands in the Ohio country did not end with him, however, and other Native leaders such as Tecumseh and Little Turtle would also try to form such an alliance to stop the westward expansion into the 1700s and 1800s. And I've been reading quite a bit about this with Alan Eckert's book that I'm reading right now. So if anyone is interested, you can still find his books in the library and, of course, online. But a very good author and a very good way to get an education about the early Ohio country in the Northwest Territory.
Mm-hmm.
So today, I want to talk a little bit about the old Ohio Penitentiary. Are you familiar with it at all, Mike?
Now, is that the one in Mansfield, or is that the one that was in Columbus?
That's the one that was in Columbus.
Okay.
It's been gone for a number of years.
Yes.
And a lot of people don't even realize that there was an Ohio penitentiary in downtown Columbus. Sometimes today, when you say the Ohio penitentiary, people think about the old Mansfield Reformatory, which was built later on from the Ohio penitentiary. But interestingly enough, if you've been there, you know that they have, and I'm not sure whether it's the real Sparky or a replica, but they have either the real or a replica of Sparky, the old electric chair that was in the Ohio Penitentiary.
Mm-hmm. I've seen that, yes.
But the old Ohio Penitentiary, and I'll just refer to it as the Ohio Penitentiary from now on, opened in Columbus in 1834, and it did continue to house prisoners until 1979, which is a little bit later date than what most people would think. It was located downtown, not too awfully far from the river, and right in the High Street area. The state had built a smaller prison in Columbus back in 1813, but the state was only 10 years old then when that prison was built. But as the state's population, of course, grew, that earlier facility was not able to handle the number of prisoners that were being sent to it by the courts. So even in the early part of the state's history, there were a lot of crimes being committed against, you know, our fellow men,
mm-hmm.
unfortunately. When the penitentiary was first opened in 1834, not all the buildings were completed. And I have a couple of early pictures of the old Ohio Penitentiary. And initially, just the one main building was built, and then there were a number of buildings built in succession after that, and they formed kind of like a square. And if you remember seeing pictures of the old Mansfield Reformatory, which is now a 501c3 run by a historical group over there, they've torn down all the adjoining buildings that were out behind the main building. And a lot of people, when they watch Shawshank Redemption, they see those buildings. A lot of those buildings were still there but when the movie was made. But, of course, now if you visit over there, those buildings are long since gone, and just the original facade, the main building, was there. A separate facility for women prisoners was completed within the walls of the Ohio Penitentiary a few years after it was built in 1837. And I didn't know this until I started doing a little research on this, that the women's prison was with the men. Of course, today, that prison is located over on the other side of Marysville.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. But then a number of women served on death row in the prison and ultimately faced execution there, either by hanging early on or by the electric chair, old Sparky. Now, of course, it's called the Ohio Reformatory for Women, and that was completed in 1913. So women were actually there at the old Ohio prison for, almost 75 years, I guess you could say.
Oh, wow.
And I have been to the Ohio Reformatory for Women a number of times over the years when I was working for the Sheriff's Department transporting prisoners. I took a number of women over there in my 10 years doing that. So that's kind of an interesting place. Almost looks like a campus.
It does.
Over there when you initially go in. Now, of course, they've built a lot of buildings over there since then. The Ohio Penitentiary in the 19th century reflected the common belief that a prison was more for punishment than for rehabilitation. And, of course, that's not like it is today. Rehabilitation is the main thing that they're concentrating on with the prison system that exists in Ohio today. Conditions within the prison were very primitive, as you can imagine. In 1834, they weren't building for comfort. We don't think as prisons being built for comfort today, but compared to what a prisoner might have gone through in the Ohio Penitentiary in 1834 compared to what they might go through in, Mansi or the prison here in Marion, quite a lot of difference. Prisoners first slept on straw mattresses, although eventually they did build some beds for them. Food was very simple, usually consisting of cornbread, beans, and bacon, and that was kind of what you got all the time, you know, every day. Prisoners were required to work in one of the prison industries, and they did everything there from making harnesses and shoes to barrels and brooms. They were really self-sufficient, and they even had a little prison farm, so they were able to grow a lot of the food that they ate. Obviously, because of the close quarters and the times that they were living in then, with medical conditions the way they were, diseases spread very rapidly. And in the 1930, the Ohio Penitentiary became the site of the worst fire in American prison history, and a total of 322 lives were lost in that fire.
Oh, wow.
And I read something about that fire earlier, but I'd really kind of forgotten it. In 1885, the penitentiary became the site for all executions, which had before that been carried out by local law enforcement officials. Did you know that?
I did know that, yes.
There were a number of hangings up in Wyandotte County over the years. Not quite sure about Marion County. I'm sure they had their few, too, and I know there were some over in Crawford County as well.
Mm-hmm.
So really, not until 1885 did they start doing the executions. At first, prisoners condemned to death were executed by hanging, which is really a very gruesome way to die.
Sure.
But in 1897, the electric chair replaced the prison's gallows. A total of 315 prisoners, both men and women, were electrocuted between 1897 and 1963 when the death penalty was halted here in Ohio. And I don't have any, I wasn't able to find any figures on how many people were hung in the gallows there, either men or women, in the information that I was able to find. But interesting to know that there were that many that went to the electric chair there.
Mm-hmm.
In the early 20th century, the Ohio Penitentiary and other prisons in Ohio began to come under attack, introducing, you know, now women's suffrage groups and people that were interested in cruelty. Conditions within the facility were not good, and of course the public view of prisons was beginning to change. In addition, there were problems with bribery and prisoners with the connections could get better treatment than the rest. So if you were somebody that was more notable in your community and committed a crime and went to prison, you had some money by bribing their guards and the staff. You could get things brought into you, or you could get maybe a better cell, or a cell by yourself, or a window, or some sort of better treatment than the rest of the people were experiencing. On April the 21st of 1930, the Ohio Penitentiary experienced the worst disaster in its history. The fire that broke out in the early evening eventually killed 322 inmates. That's quite a few.
Yeah.
Not only was the state penitentiary the worst fire in Ohio history, but up until that time, it was also the worst fire in U.S. prison history. And I wasn't able to find out whether there had been any greater loss of life due to a fire in any other prison in the country after that, so it may still hold that record. Obviously not a good record to hold, but, that is the way it was. There was a little debate about the source of the fire. Apparently, a candle had been ignited and ignited some oily rags that were left on the roof of the West Block, also known as the Big Block of the penitentiary. The fire became noticeable just after prisoners were locked into their cells for the evening. Although many, of course, of the inmates died from flames, others were perished after breathing the poisonous smoke from some of the burning lumber. And if you remember, back in those days, lumber was oftentimes treated with creosote.
Oh, yes.
So I'm sure there were some pretty nasty, noxious fumes coming from the lumber from that. Of course, and the prison was constructed of not only lumber, but also block. The reason why someone started the fire and why it turned into such a tragedy has been more heavily disputed. Prison officials claimed that there were three prisoners hoping to start a diversion so they could escape and actually started the fire intentionally. Two of the three accused inmates died by suicide in the months following the fire, which would kind of indicate that maybe that substantiated that claim that they did have a part in that, although it was never really proven whether it was an accident or it was actually set.
Oh, okay.
Other observers believe that the fire had been just a tragic accident, which, it could have been. They felt that prison officials had accused the inmates as a means of diverting attention away from the administration's poor handling of the emergency. But, in in that particular time in 1930, you know, fire departments weren't what they are today. They had pumpers, obviously, but, you know, trying to pump water out of the Scioto River, especially in the spring of the year, depending on how flooded it was, might not have been one of the easiest things to do either. So I'm sure they had their problems, the fire department had their problems trying to battle that fire. Regardless of the cause, conditions within the penitentiary had been ripe for disaster for a number of years. There had been a lot of concern about crowded conditions within the penitentiary for more than 20 years. By 1930, the prison held an inmate population that was twice as large as its original capacity. Responding to this problem after the fire, prison administrators transferred several hundred inmates to a prison farm in London, Ohio. And actually, that prison farm in London, Ohio, the prison still exists in London. There's a couple of prisons down there, actually, which is in Madison County. There's Madison Correctional, and then there's London as well. And, of course, up until just recently, the Ohio prison system still maintained prison farms. Mansi had a prison farm. They did farming here in Marion. Mm-hmm. Piqua was a huge prison farm. There was a prison there that had a huge prison system, farming system that was going on. That just really ended here, I think, within the last maybe 5 or 6 years.
Yes, it did. Mm-hmm.
This move didn't solve the greater problems that Ohio's prison systems faced. In the aftermath of that fire, the state legislature created measures to address the overcrowding. And in 1931, the General Assembly established the Ohio Parole Board, which they didn't have up until that time. And that, of course, led to the eventual release of thousands of prisoners who had been incarcerated for life and or had maybe the possibility of parole, but no board to review it. After the fire in 1930, there were even more demands for prison reform. Most of the changes took place after World War II, although reforms didn't really come quickly enough to keep three prison riots from occurring at the old Ohio Penitentiary. And then, of course, in recent times, if you'll remember 20-odd years ago, they had a big riot down at the Lucasville prison.
Oh, yes, I remember that.
Yeah, which resulted in the death of at least one corrections officer that I remember, and I think there were some inmates that died in that as well.
Mm-hmm.
Attention was paid to conditions of overcrowding in the post-war years, but prison morale was also becoming a very serious issue at that time. The worst riot there at the old Ohio Penitentiary occurred in June of 1968. A number of the buildings were destroyed, and five convicts were killed. After that riot, the state of Ohio began an investigation, which led to the decision to replace the facility. So that was kind of the beginning of the end. Over the years, thousands of prisoners were imprisoned within the Ohio Penitentiary. In April of 1955, the prison population reached a peak with 5,235 prisoners living there, which was double what the original capacity was. And I thought I had that original capacity someplace, but I can't seem to find it in my notes here right now. But I think it was about double. It seemed to me like it was around 2,600 or 2,700 people that it was originally designed to hold. Some memorable inmates of the penitentiary over the years included General John H. Morgan during the Civil War. And people may remember Morgan's Raiders, the only Confederate group, or the only Confederate cavalry group that came across the Ohio River into Ohio. And there were some skirmishes down around Malta, McConnellsville. There's a park down there that is dedicated to Morgan's Raiders that came in. I think it's called, I want to say Big Bottom Park, that general area. But there were some skirmishes clear across southern Ohio running from Marietta all the way over to Cincinnati. So he was incarcerated there. George Bugs Moran, who was kind of a popular gangster back in the 20s and 30s, was incarcerated there, as well as Sam Shepard, and that should be a name familiar to at least most people in Ohio that I would say would be at least 50 years or older. They should remember Sam Shepard. He's the man, the doctor, Dr. Sam Shepard, who lived up on the lake. I can't remember the name of the little town. Do you remember the name of the town?
I do not remember.
Yeah, it was one of the small lake towns. Very popular physician up in that area, and he supposedly killed his wife. And I say supposedly because he was found guilty, but then at a later date he was turned loose. And there's still his son, who is also named Sam Shepard, is still trying to clear his father's name to this day. William Sidney Porter was also incarcerated there in the late 1890s. Does that name ring any bells with you? William Sidney Porter?
That name sounds familiar for some reason, but I don't know why.
Well, when I tell you, you'll remember. He found his pen name while he was serving in the penitentiary, and his pen name was O. Henry.
Oh, yes, I have heard that before. Yes, yes, yes.
And, of course, wrote a tremendous amount of short stories. The Gift of the Magi being the one that comes to mind right away that I can think of, where the husband sold his watch to buy his wife a beautiful hair braid, and she had her hair cut to buy him a watch fob.
Right.
On Christmas morning, they exchanged gifts, and neither one had the hair nor the watch to use their gift from. But yeah, he discovered his pen name there and wrote quite a bit while he was in the penitentiary.
And he invented that candy bar, didn't he?
Yeah, I don't think he invented it, but he was given, the name came from him.
Oh, it did? Okay.
It did, yeah.
Okay.
I don't know what the connection was, but that's where the name came from. I read that someplace once.
Hmm.
Other famous inmates, Harry Pierpoint, Charles Mackley, and Russell Clark, which I didn't really remember those names, but they were members of John Dillinger's gang. And everybody knew who John Dillinger was. You know, he came through Ohio and robbed several banks in this area. In fact, up in Fremont, there's an old bank building up there that's, I think it's being used like as a visitor center or something now. They still have gunshots in the walls from John Dillinger's gang.
Well, they hit a bank over in Cardington, too.
Yeah, did they hit that one as well?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think there was one in Bettsville that they robbed, too, if I'm not mistaken. So they were there. The state of Ohio decided to replace the old prison with a new modern facility in Lucasville, Ohio. And that, of course, is called the Southern Ohio Correctional Facility. And that actually began to receive prisoners from the Ohio Penitentiary in 1972. So it doesn't seem like it's been that long that it's been there. And the interesting thing about that is most people didn't know where Lucasville, Ohio was or even heard of Lucasville until they built the prison there.
Right.
Kind of put the town of Lucasville on the map. And that's my original home.
Oh, okay.
I was born in Portsmouth at the old Portsmouth Hospital and grew up in Lucasville. We had a farm just north of Lucasville.
Mm-hmm.
Court decisions ultimately ordered the prison to be closed in 1979, and the last prisoner required to leave was December 31st of 1983. So they were still housing a few there. And then it was torn down a little bit later on. The deadline was extended by 8 months, and the last prisoners were transported to other facilities. The city of Columbus actually bought the old penitentiary in 1995. After a lot of discussion as to the best use of the site, the buildings were demolished to make way for a lot of new development. And back at that time, I remember, a lot of people were trying to buy bricks from the old Ohio Penitentiary as a souvenir. I was never fortunate enough to get one. I don't know. Did you, by any chance, get one yourself?
I did not, no.
Yeah. But I know that there was a concerted effort by local historians to make those available to different people that wanted them as souvenirs. So I suppose there's a lot of them that kind of got out. I know when they tore the old Sycamore Elementary School down a number of years ago, my mother went down and scavenged a couple of bricks for me and my son because my son went to elementary school there. So I'm sure there's some bricks around in the old Ohio Penitentiary. Well, that's most of the information that I was able to get on the Ohio Penitentiary. But I wanted to conclude today, and I think, what do we got, about 8 minutes or so?
About 9 minutes.
About 9 minutes. Mm-hmm. I wanted to conclude with some readings from the diary of a gentleman by the name of the Reverend James B. Findlay. Now, I don't know whether your readers or your listeners would know Reverend Findlay or not. It's F-I-N-L-E-Y. But he was an itinerant Methodist preacher that rode horseback throughout the state of Ohio in his early years and preached the gospel to a lot of the Indian savages. He spent a lot of time in Upper Sandusky. He traveled through Marion. He preached all along the western border of the state of Ohio from Cincinnati all the way up to Maumee, and then traveled down through central Ohio. And then in 1846, he was assigned to the old Ohio Penitentiary and spent a number of years there. And he kept a diary, actually kept a number of diaries throughout his ministerial career, which spanned, I think, around 70 years, a lot of it on horseback. But excuse me, I'm going to get a sip of water here.
Okay, go right ahead, Fred. Didn't that penitentiary stand for a while before it was torn down?
Yes, absolutely, right. Mm-hmm. Right.
I remember driving by there while it was still there. I think it went down to Red, White, and Boom one year and parked near there, and it was still standing.
Well, it was still standing, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, it was later on. It was after, it was, I think, maybe 96, 97. I didn't find the actual date that they tore it down, but it was later on before they tore it down. But anyway, getting back to Reverend Findlay, I just wanted to read a few excerpts from his diary here. We've got a little bit of time.
Mm-hmm.
Just because he talks about you know, what it was like being in the prison and some of his experiences there. On the second day of April, 1846, and I'm reading directly from his diary, I commenced my labors as chaplain in the penitentiary of Ohio. In company with the Reverend Granville Moody and a Dr. Guard, I passed through every part of the spacious prison. The workshops, the cells, and eating halls were among the first and principal objects of my attention. Having never before been within the walls of this institution, the sight of the degradation and misery which here became apparent greatly affected me. Often had I attempted to describe in the public congregation this latter end of vice, but what I now behold beggared all description. Here were all ranks and ages, from the man of high life to the meanest pickpocket, from the gray-haired man of 80 down to the boy of 14 years. They were all dressed in striped clothing. All seemed depressed and broken down in spirits. All were silently at work, without the hope of remuneration, under the inspection of well-appointed watchers, a dark cloud of melancholy, betokening the anguish of their meditations, was settled on every countenance. Oh, my God, I inwardly exclaimed, what a life, what a condition for an immoral creature. Isn't that awful?
Oh, that's terrible. Yeah.
I'm going to move on to another portion here. As I returned from the hospital, the guards and other officers were inflicting the punishment, technically called showering, to 11 of the prisoners for a breach of the rules. This operation, which is one of the most terrible to the prisoners, generally may need description. The prisoner is tied to a plank. His feet are confined at the bottom, and the head is held in place by a sort of headstall, so that he can neither move his head, nor feet, nor hands, nor any part of his body. He is absolutely pinioned to this place. The plank is set upright. From above the poor victim, there comes down a spout of cold water, about half an inch in diameter, with a tremendous force, directly on his naked head. No one without experience knows anything of the torture of this infliction. Men of great physical strength will endure it for some time without giving signs of pain, but most prisoners look upon this punishment with inexpressible horror. I may add that it is recently in many prisons taken the place of whipping, but the reader must decide upon its merits as a mode of punishment. Isn't that terrible? You can see why there were some people out there that were feigning that they do something about the punishment and the treatment of some of these prisoners. I've got another excerpt here. I'll get to it. Saturday, June the 13th. Yesterday, the warden ordered a change to be made in the suppers of the convicts. This meal had before consisted of a piece of cornbread and a cup of water. It was now to consist of mush and molasses. I need not say to those acquainted with well-conducted prisons that such food as is given the inmates is always of the very best quality. But really, with this consideration, with all the appetite produced by hard labor, a dry crust of coarse bread with water is certainly not a feast. This morning I passed my time entirely with the prisoners. Nothing was talked of but their change of diet. Not a very good diet to look forward to every day, is it?
No, it's not. I mean, day after day. Maybe day occasionally, day. But yes.
Got a couple more here. Do we have a minute or so yet?
About 2 minutes.
Okay. Tuesday, June 22nd. Very early this morning, I went into the shops to spend the day with the prisoners. I went to hear their complaints. This was my only business, and I had told them so in plain words. I then went this morning to the female prison, being anxious to know how the women might feel affected since their excursion. I never saw so kind, so peaceable, so tender. I was much encouraged and held a prayer meeting with them before dinner. They all manifested a good degree of feeling. I then talked with them individually. They gave me answers to every question and even the most searching with the parent chilfriness. So apparently it was a little bit better for the women than it was for the men.
It sounds like it.
And finally, on Wednesday, June 24th, after breakfast, I found the man at work all alone in a solitary place. Poor fellow. He is in for life. I went to him and addressed him kindly. He became greatly agitated while I was talking with him. He wished to know if I thought God was such a being that he would or could pardon a wretch like him.
Hmm.
Of this I gave him every assurance from the scriptures and showed on what terms God dispensed his pardons. He then told me the crime for which he was committed. It was for killing a boy. I will relate his story for the sake of juvenile readers. A group of boys saw a drunkard carrying a gun staggering across the field. They pursued him and mocked him and pelted him. The drunkard, not knowing what he was about, drew his gun, fired upon the boy, and killed one of their number.
Oh.
The murderer was the man before me. He handed me a recent letter from his wife, from which I gave an extract. The reader, in order to understand the feelings of that woman properly, must remember that she regards her husband as guilty, not of murder, nor manslaughter, but of drunkenness, in which state he committed the deed.
You're listening to WWGH Radio.
Okay, Fred,
Ohio, Talking Place.
We'll have you back in about another month.
Okay, that was my last quote.
Okay.
Have a good one.
Okay, Fred.
Electricity, if we have problems with our